All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be talking about Quan v. the Andelix Group. This case is like a total must-know for anyone trying to wrap their heads around Title VII retaliation claims, especially that tricky but-for causation standard.
Yeah, it's huge, especially the whole idea of what kind of evidence can actually convince a court that, retaliation was the reason, the decisive factor behind some employment decision.
Right. So whether you're just starting out in law school or you've been in the game for a while, there's a lot to learn from Kwan. We're going to really dig into the nitty-gritty of the case and try to figure out what it tells us about how to prove or defend against these kinds of claims.
Absolutely. I think that's key. Going beyond just the surface level and really extracting those practical insights.
And to do that, we went right to the source. We're looking at the actual case excerpts, the briefs,
Yeah,
everything.
the real deal.
Our mission here is to break down Quan v. the Andelix Group and make it clear, get rid of all the legal jargon, especially for law students who are dealing with these really complex employment law
It
issues.
can be a lot to wade through.
Totally. So let's just jump right in. Can you set the scene for us? What happened in this case?
Okay, so we start with Zhang Quan, who was a vice president at Andelix Group.
Okay.
And back in August 2008, she went to the company's COO, chief operating officer,
Yep.
with concerns about what she saw as a gender pay gap.
Mm.
Really important to remember, speaking up about something like that's a protected activity under Title VII.
Right. And then what? I mean, it seems like things moved pretty fast after that, didn't they?
Yeah, super fast. So only 3 weeks after she makes that complaint, September 26, 2008, to be exact, Andelix fires her.
Yeah, 3 weeks.
Yeah. Then in February 2010, Quan filed a lawsuit against Andelix. It's a pretty broad lawsuit, alleging all kinds of violations. She claimed retaliation, obviously, but also discrimination based on gender and national origin, hostile work environment, and even some stuff related to her COBRA benefits under ERISA.
So she was really covering all the bases.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so what happened next? How did the district court handle all of that?
Well, the first stop was the district court, and Andelix actually managed to get summary judgment on all of Quan's claims.
Remind me what summary judgment is again.
Basically, it means the court decides there's no real dispute about the facts of the case, and one side wins purely based on the law. There's no need for a trial.
Got it. So that was a pretty big win for Andelix, at least at that stage.
Oh, yeah. But Quan wasn't done yet. She appealed that district court decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit.
Okay, and that's where things start to get really interesting, particularly for this deep dive.
Exactly. That's where the case takes a big turn, especially when it comes to the retaliation claim.
So what did the Second Circuit decide? Did they side with the lower court on everything?
Well, they upheld the summary judgment on the discrimination and hostile work environment claims.
Okay.
But here's the big thing. They reversed the summary judgment on the retaliation claim and sent that part back to the district court.
Interesting. So the retaliation claim is really at the heart of why we're talking about this case today. But before we get into the Second Circuit's thinking, can you remind us what the basic legal elements of a Title VII retaliation claim are? What does a plaintiff have to prove to even get their case off the ground?
Sure. To bring a Title VII retaliation claim, a plaintiff has to establish four key things. First, they have to show they were engaged in protected activity. That could be complaining about discrimination, taking part in an investigation, opposing some kind of discriminatory practice, that sort of thing.
Right, makes sense. What's the second thing?
Second, they have to show the employer knew about that protected activity. Third, they have to prove they suffered some kind of adverse employment action, like being fired, demoted, or having their job significantly changed in a negative way.
And finally, the causal link.
Exactly. That's the fourth thing. They have to demonstrate that there's a connection between the protected activity and the adverse action.
And wasn't there a Supreme Court case, Nassar, that really raise the bar when it comes to proving that causal link, especially in retaliation cases?
Oh, absolutely. Nassar was a game changer. Before that, in 2013, some courts used a motivating factor standard. Basically, if the protected activity was just one of the reasons for the adverse action, that was enough. But Nassar laid down a much stricter but-for causation standard.
So what does that mean, but for causation?
It means the plaintiff has to prove that the adverse action wouldn't have happened but for the retaliatory motive. In other words, retaliation has to be the main reason, the deciding factor.
Got it. So it's not enough for it to be just one factor among many.
Exactly.
Okay, so how does this but-for standard work within the bigger picture of how these cases are analyzed? Like that whole burden-shifting framework we always hear about in employment law?
That's a great question. Courts often use the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting framework in both discrimination and retaliation cases.
Right.
So first, the plaintiff has to present a prima facie case.
Which is what? Just enough evidence to sort of create a presumption of retaliation?
Exactly. It's like their initial showing.
Mm.
If they can do that, then the burden shifts to the employer. Now, they have to provide a legitimate, non-retaliatory reason for why they took that adverse action.
Okay, I'm following.
Then, if the employer can do that, the burden shifts back to the plaintiff one last time.
Right.
Now they have to show that the employer's reason is just a pretext, a cover-up, for the real retaliatory motive.
That makes sense. Okay, so bringing it back to Kwan, what specific evidence convinced the Second Circuit that Kwan had made that initial prima facie case of retaliation? What jumped out at them?
They really focus on two things. First, the timing.
Yeah, that 3-week gap between the complaint and her termination.
Exactly. Courts often look at that very closely. When an adverse action happens so soon after a protected activity, it can raise some eyebrows. They might see a connection there.
It definitely seems suspicious.
Right. The second thing they pointed to was what they called corporate knowledge.
Okay, what's that?
Basically, because Kwan had made her complaint to the COO, that means a top executive knew about it.
Right.
So the court saw that as knowledge being attributed to the company as a whole.
So it doesn't matter that maybe the person who actually made the decision to fire her didn't know about the complaint.
Right, because a high-ranking official like the COO knew. The company itself is considered to have known.
That makes sense. So they established the prima facie case. What happened next? Didn't Andalex try to explain why they fired Kwan?
Oh, they did. Their initial explanation was that they were firing Kwan because the company was shifting its business strategy. They were moving away from domestic real estate and focusing more on international gaming and hospitality. And they presented that as a legitimate business decision that, yeah, you know, just meant they needed to make some personnel changes.
Sounds plausible on the surface.
Yeah. But that wasn't the whole story, was it?
No, it wasn't. And this is where things get really tricky. And as you said earlier, this is where we can learn a lot from how this case played out.
Exactly. Because later on, Andalix gave a different reason for firing Kwan.
Oh. What was it this time?
This time they focused on her performance, claiming she had performance issues and some behavioral problems.
Hmm, okay.
And this change in their explanation, that became a major focus for the Second Circuit, as they considered whether Andalix was just trying to cover up a retaliatory motive.
So the Second Circuit was troubled by the fact that Andalix changed their story.
Yeah, because they saw it as creating a genuine dispute about the facts.
Like, if they're giving different reasons at different times, maybe they're not being totally truthful?
Exactly. And that can raise doubts about their credibility and whether their reasons are genuine. It's like they're hiding something, you know?
Right, right.
And that's why the court said, discrepancies let jurors infer pretext.
Meaning a jury might think that the employer's stated reasons aren't the real reasons.
Exactly.
That's a really important takeaway for employers, right? Like, they need to be consistent in their reasoning when they make these decisions, especially if an employee has engaged in protected activity.
Oh, absolutely. If the story keeps changing, it can look really bad in court.
Totally. Okay, so we've talked about the majority opinion, but wasn't there a dissenting judge in this case?
There was.
What was their take?
Well, the dissenting judge felt that just the timing, that 3-week proximity, wasn't enough to prove pretext, especially since Andalex had given other reasons for firing Kwan.
So they thought there was more to the story than just the timing.
Right. They felt that the 3 weeks, while maybe suspicious, wasn't enough to outweigh what they saw as legitimate business reasons.
And what did they think about Andalex's shifting explanations?
They saw those differently than the majority. They argued that the two reasons, the change in business focus and Kwan's performance issues, weren't necessarily contradictory.
Like maybe they were connected in some way.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They suggested that the company's new strategic direction might have meant they needed different skills and higher performance standards, which Kwan maybe wasn't meeting.
Okay.
And the dissent also pointed out that Andalex had documentation about Kwan's performance problems, and Kwan hadn't really refuted that evidence.
So it seems like the heart of the disagreement was about how to interpret the evidence. Mm-hmm. The majority focused on those changing explanations, but the dissent was more persuaded by the performance issues.
Yeah, and they thought the majority was giving too much weight to the inconsistencies in Andalex's explanations, without paying enough attention to those document performance concerns.
Really interesting. This case really gets into some fascinating nuances of retaliation law. One thing that stood out to me was this idea of corporate knowledge. Can you explain that a bit more, especially how it worked in Quan?
Absolutely. So corporate knowledge comes up a lot in these larger companies. It basically addresses situations where the person who actually fires someone might not be the same person who knew about, say, a discrimination complaint.
Right. Okay.
And in Quan, the Second Circuit made it clear that in a retaliation case, you don't always have to prove that the specific person who fired you knew about the protected activity.
So what's the alternative?
Well, if someone high up in the company, like the COO in this case, knew about the protected activity, then that knowledge can be applied to the company as a whole.
So in Quan, even if the person who actually fired Quan didn't know she'd complained to the COO, the company itself was still considered to have known.
Exactly. That's how the law sees it.
That's a really important point, especially for understanding how these big companies can be held liable. It's not just about the individual decision maker.
Exactly.
Another thing that's interesting about this case is the procedural stage at which the Second Circuit made its decision. They were ruling on summary judgment, right? Why is that so important for how we understand Quan?
Oh, that's crucial. Because at the summary judgment stage, the court isn't deciding whether retaliation actually happened. They're just deciding if there are enough disagreements about the facts to justify a trial.
Okay.
So when the Second Circuit reversed summary judgment on the retaliation claim, they were saying Quan had presented enough evidence that a reasonable jury could decide in her favor. They weren't saying she was definitely retaliated against.
They were just saying it was a question for a jury to decide.
Exactly.
So it was a procedural win for Quan, not necessarily a final victory.
Right. She got the chance to have her case heard by a jury, which is a big deal in itself.
It is. Okay, so to wrap things up, what are the biggest lessons we should take away from Quan v. Andelix Group, especially for law students who are learning about these concepts?
Okay, well, first of all, Quan is a huge reminder that employers need to have good documentation for any employment decisions, especially when it involves someone who's engaged in protected activity.
Right, like if they're giving different reasons for firing someone, it just looks bad.
Exactly. It can be seen as evidence of pretext. Remember, discrepancies let jurors infer pretext.
That's a good one to remember.
It is. Second, Quan shows us that even with that tough but-for standard from Nassar, you can still prove retaliation if you can show a strong temporal connection between the protected activity and the adverse action, especially if there are other signs that the employer's reasons aren't genuine.
Like those shifting explanations.
Exactly.
So timing matters, but it's often stronger when you have other evidence to back it up.
Right. Third, this case shows us how important those procedural battles at the summary judgment stage can be in retaliation cases.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, it comes down to whether the plaintiff has presented enough evidence to create a real dispute about the facts.
So understanding that summary judgment standard is key.
Absolutely. And lastly, that concept of general corporate knowledge is really important for understanding how the knowledge element works in a retaliation claim. If someone high up knows, the company knows.
And that can be enough to establish liability.
Exactly.
This has been a really insightful discussion. Thanks for breaking down Quan for us.
No problem. Happy to do it.
As we wrap up this deep dive into Quan v. the Andelix Group, here's something to think about, especially for the law students listening. How could you use the discovery process in litigation to try and uncover inconsistencies in an employer's reasons for taking some kind of adverse action? And what are the ethical considerations you should be thinking about when you're doing that? It's something to keep in mind as you continue your legal studies.
A great question.
Thanks for joining us for the deep dive. We'll see you next time.